Welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I bet, like me, you've been intrigued by all the recent news about J.D. Salinger, his new biography, and the controversy about his life after he wrote Catcher in the Rye. It got me thinking, there are so many titles originally classified for teens, but which have evolved into icons of our literary landscape. Consider these, often heading up every best of list in the category. Harry Potter, The Hunger Games, To Kill a Mockingbird, The Fault in Our Stars, The Hobbit, Catcher in the Rye, Lord of the Rings, Fahrenheit 451, and The Book Thief. I know I've read all of them. And on the show today, we'll preview diverse titles important to anyone who has a teen in their life or who thinks back to their own challenging teen years. And did you realize that this week, September 22 to 28, is Banned Book Week? It's the National Book Community's annual celebration of the freedom to read. Hundreds of libraries and bookstores around the country draw attention to the problem of censorship. They mount displays of challenged books and host a variety of events. And I'm very pleased to report that several of today's titles have also made this year's banned book list. I'll point out which as we go along. Lots of ground to cover, so let's get started as we turn to page one of the book report. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable, small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. John Green's Looking for Alaska is number 7 in this year's banned book list. The Book Report recently previewed another of Green's incredibly popular titles, The Fault in Our Stars. You'll find that excerpt on archived shows, bookreportradio.com, February 9, 2013. Miles Halter is fascinated by famous last words and tired of his safe life at home. He leaves for boarding school to seek what the dying poet Rabelais called the great perhaps. Much awaits Miles at Culver Creek, including Alaska Young. Clever, funny, screwed up, and incredibly sexy, Alaska will pull Miles into her labyrinth and catapult him into the great perhaps. Jeff Woodman narrates.
Florida was plenty hot, certainly, and humid, too. Hot enough that your clothes stuck to you like scotch tape, and sweat dripped like tears from your forehead into your eyes. But it was only hot outside, and generally I only went outside to walk from one air-conditioned location to another. This did not prepare me for the unique sort of heat that one encounters 15 miles south of Birmingham, Alabama, at Culver Creek Preparatory School. My parents' SUV was parked in the grass just a few feet outside my dorm room, room 43. But each time I took those few steps to and from the car to unload what now seemed like far too much stuff, the sun burned through my clothes and into my skin with a vicious ferocity that made me genuinely fear hellfire. Between Mom and Dad and me, it only took a few minutes to unload the car, but my un-air-conditioned dorm room, although blessedly out of the sunshine, was only modestly cooler. The room surprised me. I'd pictured plush carpet, wood-paneled walls, Victorian furniture. Aside from one luxury, a private bathroom, I got a box, with cinder block walls coated thick with layers of white paint, and a green and white checkered linoleum floor. The place looked more like a hospital than the dorm room of my fantasies. A bunk bed of unfinished wood with vinyl mattresses was pushed against the room's back window. The desks and dressers and bookshelves were all attached to the walls in order to prevent creative floor planning. And no air conditioning. I sat on the lower bunk while Mom opened the trunk, grabbed a stack of the biographies my dad had agreed to part with, and placed them on the bookshelves. "I can unpack, Mom," I said. My dad stood. He was ready to go.
"Let me at least make your bed," Mom said.
"No, really, I can do it. It's okay." Because you simply cannot draw these things out forever. At some point, you just pull off the Band-Aid and it hurts, but then it's over and you're relieved. God, we'll miss you, Mom said suddenly, stepping through the minefield of suitcases to get to the bed. I stood and hugged her. My dad walked over too, and we formed a sort of huddle. It was too hot, and we were too sweaty for the hug to last terribly long. I knew I ought to cry, but I'd lived with my parents for 16 years, and a trial separation seemed overdue. Don't worry, I smiled. I'se gonna learn how to talk right Southern. Mom laughed. Don't do anything stupid, my dad said. Okay. No drugs, no drinking, no cigarettes. As an alumnus of Culver Creek, he had done the things I had only heard about. The secret parties, streaking through hayfields. He always whined about how it was all boys back then. Drugs, drinking, and cigarettes. It had taken him a while to kick smoking, but his days were now well behind him. I love you, they both blurted out simultaneously. It needed to be said, but the words made the whole thing horribly uncomfortable, like watching your grandparents kiss. I love you too. I'll call every Sunday. Our rooms had no phone lines, but my parents had requested I be placed in a room near one of Culver Creek's 5 payphones. They hugged me again, Mom, then Dad, and it was over. Out the back window, I watched them drive the winding road off campus. I should have felt a gooey sentimental sadness, perhaps, but mostly I just wanted to cool off. So I grabbed one of the desk chairs and sat down outside my door in the shade of the overhanging eaves, waiting for a breeze that never arrived. The air outside sat as still and oppressive as the air inside. I stared out over my new digs. 6 one-story buildings, each with 16 dorm rooms, were arranged in a hexagram around a large circle of grass. It looked like an oversized old motel. Everywhere, boys and girls hugged and smiled and walked together. I vaguely hoped that someone would come up and talk to me. I imagined the conversation. Hey, is this your first year? Yeah, I'm from Florida. That's cool, so you're used to the heat. I wouldn't be used to this heat if I were from Hades, I'd joke. I'd make a good first impression. Oh, he's funny. That guy Miles is a riot. That didn't happen, of course. Things never happened like I imagined them. Bored, I went back inside, took off my shirt, laid down on the heat-soaked vinyl of the lower bunk mattress, and closed my eyes. I'd never been born again, with the baptism and weeping and all that, but it couldn't feel much better than being born again as a guy with no known past.
We've just heard Looking for Alaska by John Green. Jay Asher's 13 Reasons Why garnered the number 3 spot in this year's banned book list. The story is this. Clay Jensen returns home from school to find a strange package with his name on it lying on his porch. Inside, he discovers several cassette tapes recorded by Hannah Baker, his classmate and crush, who had tragically committed suicide 2 weeks earlier. Hannah's voice explains there are 13 reasons why she decided to end her life. Clay is one of them. If he listens, he'll find out why. Clay spends the night crisscrossing town with Hannah as his guide. In doing so, he becomes a first-hand witness to Hannah's pain and learns the truth about himself, a truth he never wanted to face. Deborah Wiseman and Joel Johnstone perform the title.
Sir, she repeats, how soon do you want it to get there? I rub 2 fingers hard over my left eyebrow. The throbbing has become intense. It doesn't matter, I say. The clerk takes the package. The same shoebox that sat on my porch less than 24 hours ago, rewrapped in a brown paper bag, sealed with clear packing tape, exactly as I had received it. But now addressed with a new name, the next name on Hannah Baker's list. Baker's dozen, I mumble. Then I feel disgusted for even noticing it. Excuse me? I shake my head. How much is it? She places the box on a rubber pad, then punches a sequence on her keypad. I set my cup of gas station coffee on the counter and glance at the screen. I pull a few bills from my wallet, dig some coins out of my pocket, and place my money on the counter. I don't think the coffee's kicked in yet, she says. You're missing a dollar. I hand over the extra dollar, then rub the sleep from my eyes. The coffee's lukewarm when I take a sip, making it harder to gulp down. But I need to wake up somehow. Or maybe not. Maybe it's best to get through the day half asleep. Maybe that's the only way to get through today. It should arrive at this address tomorrow, she says. Maybe the day after tomorrow. Then she drops the box into a cart behind her. I should have waited till after school. I should have given Jenny one final day of peace, though she doesn't deserve it. When she gets home tomorrow or the next day, she'll find a package on her doorstep. Or if her mom or dad or someone else gets there first, maybe she'll find it on her bed. And she'll be excited. I was excited. A package with no return address? Did they forget? Or was it intentional? Maybe from a secret admirer. Do you want your receipt? The clerk asks. I shake my head. A small printer clicks one out anyway. I watch her tear the slip across the serrated plastic and drop it into a wastebasket. There's only one post office in town. I wonder if the same clerk helped the other people on the list, those who got this package before me. Did they keep the receipts as sick souvenirs, tuck them in their underwear drawers, pin them up on corkboards? I almost ask for my receipt back. I almost say, I'm sorry, can I have it after all? As a reminder. But if I wanted a reminder, I could have made copies of the tapes or saved the map. But I never want to hear those tapes again, though her voice will never leave my head. And the houses, the streets, and the high school will always be there to remind me. It's out of my control now. The package is on its way. I leave the post office without the receipt. Deep behind my left eyebrow, my head is still pounding. Every swallow tastes sour, and the closer I get to school, the closer I come to collapsing. I want to collapse. I want to fall on the sidewalk right there and drag myself into the ivy. Because just beyond the ivy, the sidewalk curves following the outside of the school parking lot. It cuts through the front lawn and into the main building. It leads through the front doors and turns into a hallway, which meanders between rows of lockers and classrooms on both sides, finally entering the always open door to first period.
That was 13 Reasons Why by Jay Asher. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Braffett is the author of the new book, Save Yourself. Book Report favorite author Dennis Lehane comments, Kelly is the real deal. Save Yourself is an electrifying tomahawk missile of a thriller with honest-to-God people at its core. It rocks the house. Kelly has also written Josie and Jack and Last Seen Leaving. She attended Sarah Lawrence and Columbia Universities. Kelly currently lives in upstate New York with her author husband, Owen King. Welcome, Kelly. It's great to have you with us on the Book Report.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Elaine.
I want to congratulate you on instantly drawing readers into the story by making us care about your characters.
Well, thank you. I certainly hope that people care about them.
I do. Well, talk a little about Layla and Verna.
Well, Layla and Verna actually came out of a conversation that I had in a book club for my second novel, Last Seen Leaving, where I was talking to a group of women who were, for the most part, in their 40s and 50s, in a small town in western Pennsylvania, actually, where the book is set. And one of them commented that something she had struggled with in Last Seen Leaving was the fact that none of the characters seemed to have any faith in any sort of greater spiritual sense. And I thought, well, of course they don't, because it never occurred to me to give them any. So having realized that that was something I had never addressed, I instantly wanted to, because that's I think sort of what we do as writers, we see the holes in our previous work and try to fill them as we go forward. So I had had this idea for, I had had a desire for many years to write a book from the point of view of somebody who was from a community based in faith. And what I came up with were these two girls. Their father's a lay minister. He's a fundamentalist Christian and sort of has a ministry that he's running out of his basement, which is based primarily in abstinence, but he also has a small congregation. And the two girls were homeschooled until they hit high school. And both struggle in their own way with coming to terms with the outside world. And Verna is one of my three narrators in the book. She's one of the people whose perspective we get the most closely. And she struggles, I think, more than Layla does, really, with relating to the outside world and finding a way to reconcile the world that she came from and its expectations with the world that she suddenly finds herself thrust into and its expectations, which are very different.
Right. Okay. Next, the other duo of characters are Patrick and Mike. Tell us about them.
Well, Patrick and Mike are also sort of from a very closed family system because their mother died of cancer when Patrick was 11, and their father immediately sort of slipped into a semi-functional alcoholism. So both boys have spent, I mean, I call them boys. They're actually in their mid to late 20s by the time the story takes place. But they both spent their lives, for the most part, taking care of their father and making sure that he can function enough to get them all through life. And he, by the time the book starts, he has already been convicted of a drunk driving accident, a hit and run, where a small child was killed. And Patrick was the one who realized what he had done after he returned home and who eventually called the police. But he waited 19 hours to do that. And those 19 hours have made him the brunt of some pretty serious social criticism from their town, particularly on the internet. I worked a lot in this book with internet comments and the level of vitriol and rage that you often see in them. And it was, you know, Patrick is on the receiving end of a lot of those for the delay in reporting his father's crime.
Right.
And feels very strongly not just the shame that his father did this horrible thing, but also a terrible anger that he's being unjustly punished for it when he feels like his life is sort of punishment enough and has been. And he and Layla sort of intersect. She finds him and recognizes him from the police coverage of the story of the crime, and then sort of becomes fixated on him because she knows that she recognizes something in him, a certain sort of, they're both pariahs in a way, and they're both sort of struggling with a lot of the same issues.
Right. So, I mean, in this book, both sets of parents have failed their kids in very, very different ways. If you had high school age kids, could you help them navigate through these treacherous years?
Well, we'll find out. You know, I think that the flaw that both of these, well, you know, they're very different, both of these families. I mean, obviously, Patrick and Mike's father has his own demons that he's wrestling with. And the Elshiers, Layla and Verna's parents, what I really wanted to do with them was not make them monsters, was make them good people who were really doing what they thought was the best thing for their daughters and for the world at large. And unfortunately, their instincts sort of tend to run to taking care of the world at large and not necessarily their daughters. And they create an environment at home that is so judgmental that it becomes impossible for either Layla or Verna to come home and say, this is what's happening to me at school, this is what they're saying, this is what I'm being accused of. And I think that that is really their biggest failure, is they just sort of fail to constantly keep an open ear, if that makes any sense. They have so carved the rules of how a person should be in stone that they've made it very difficult for either of their girls to admit that something outside of those rules is happening.
Right.
And they leave them with, you know, both feeling very alone. And when they feel alone, they turn to whoever will listen, which in this case turns out to be some fairly toxic people.
Right. And one of them is a character you've written called Justinian, who seemed to me like a Jim Jones in the making. What are your thoughts about him?
Well, he is sort of a Jim Jones in the making. That's interesting. I haven't heard that comparison yet. I've heard Charles Manson, but I haven't heard Jim Jones. But it's true. Justinian is probably the closest thing I've written to a pure sociopath. I mean, he really sort of understands people's needs and how he can manipulate them. And there's a bit in the book where somebody talks about him as being fascinated with people in the sense that they're like toys that he can suddenly play with until he breaks them. And that's basically what he's doing. He finds people with weaknesses and he does his best to twist those weaknesses and see what he can do with them, to see what he can make people do. And it turns out that he can do quite a lot if he, you know, finds the right people.
Yeah. Well, are there characters from this book that you would like to revisit in a future book?
Well, actually, my third narrator, the book is told from the point of view of three different people. There's Patrick and then Verna. And then also Mike's girlfriend, Caro, is one of my favorite characters I've ever written, actually. She's also in her mid-20s. She was raised by a single mother with some pretty serious mental illnesses. And she is really sort of drifting through life, doing her best to find a safe place and a secure place. And I really felt that there were a lot of problems that I sort of encapsulated with Caro that are faced by a lot of women, particularly, you know, lower class working women these days. Issues of financial security and social security. You know, when Caro meets Mike, she's living in her car. And, you know, he doesn't have to be all that great to be a step up from living in her car. And as it turns out, you know, Mike's not a bad guy, but part of the book is her sort of coming to terms with how much she's willing to settle for, in what she's willing to trade in order to get that security that she so desperately wants.
I liked her too. I liked the way that she came from all this chaos and yet order and things, having things in their place meant a lot to her.
It really did. It really does. And some of that, I think, comes from constantly kind of she, even as a small child, was serving as the defensive wall between her mother and everybody else, trying to make the world look perfect. But I think also she's really striving to try and get the world perfect behind all of the appearances. She really wants the life that she wants to appear she has, if that makes any sense at all, which I'm not sure it does.
It does to me, because I read and very much enjoyed your book. Now, your husband's an author, as are several members of his family. Do you share your manuscripts with any or all of them to get their input?
Well, I have my group of core readers. Obviously, my husband is my first and most constant reader, Owen King. He read this book probably 7 times, and I'm not even exaggerating, start to finish, which is a really hard thing to do. And then I also have a couple of readers that I knew from graduate school that I passed books on to and who passed their books on to me. This book, for the first time, I sort of turned to my larger extended family. Both of Owen's parents are writers. And there came a point when I had sort of burned through all of my other readers, and I really wanted to get a fresh read on it. And so I asked for their input, and they were extremely helpful, both of them.
What's next for you? What are you working on currently?
Well, right now I'm still very much in the thick of promoting Save Yourself, which has changed a lot since my last novel, because now I can do so much of my promotion from my pajamas, which is awesome. I'm in the early stages of a couple of different projects. I'm sort of kicking some things around, and I'm not sure which ball is going to go into the goal.
Save Yourself is an amazing book. I read it very quickly because I wanted to see what happened with everybody. Thanks so much for joining us today. And now, let's listen to a sample of Save Yourself, performed by Michael Goldstrom.
Patrick worked the day shift at Zony's Go Mart one Wednesday a month.
sealed into the vacuum-packed chill behind the convenience store's dirty plate glass windows, watching cars zoom by on the highway while he stood still. When he worked nights, the way he usually did, the world was dark and quiet and calm outside, and it made him feel dark and quiet and calm inside. When he worked days, all he felt was trapped. So by the time he made it out of the store that evening, he was just glad to be free. His eyes were hot with exhaustion, and the odor of the place lingered on his clothes. Stale potato chips, old candy, the thick syrupy smell of the soda fountain. But the warm September air felt good. As he rounded the corner of the building and headed toward the dumpsters where he'd parked, back where the asphalt had almost crumbled into gravel and the weeds grew tall right up to the edge of the lot, the car keys in his hand were still cold from the air conditioner. That was all he was thinking about. Then he saw the goth girl leaning against his car. He'd seen her before. She'd been in the store earlier that day when Bill came by to pick up his paycheck. Patrick had kept an eye on her because he didn't have anything else to do and because she'd been there too long, with her coffee and staring into the beverage cases. Not that Patrick, personally, gave a what or how much she stole. But as long as she was there, he'd felt at least a nominal responsibility to look concerned for the security cameras. Then Bill had called her Bride of Dracula and made an obscene suggestion, and she'd called him a degenerate and stormed out in what Patrick assumed was a huff. He and Bill had laughed about it, and he hadn't thought any more about her. But now, here she was, leaning on his car like she belonged there, and staring at him with eyes as huge and merciless as camera lenses. In the dimming light, her dyed black hair and her almost black lipstick made her pale skin look nearly blue. She held a brown cigarette, even though she looked all of 16, her expression a well-rehearsed mixture of indifference and faint amusement. When she saw him, her lips curled in something like a smile. "Hello," she said. Patrick stopped. Her earrings were tiny, fully articulated human skeletons. He tried to figure out if he knew her, or somebody's kid sister that he hadn't seen since she was 10. He didn't think so. "If you're looking for weed," he told her, "you got the wrong night. That guy works Mondays." "You mean your degenerate friend from this morning?" she laughed. It was a Hollywood laugh, as stale as the air inside the store he'd just left. "Hardly." "Whatever." Patrick was too tired for this. He pointed to his car door and she moved back, but not enough. It was hard to avoid touching her as he got in. He slipped his keys into the ignition, buckled his seatbelt, and rolled down the window, all the while acutely aware of the girl's big spidery eyes staring at him through the dirty glass. He turned on the engine. She waited, watching him. He hesitated. "Do I know you?" he finally asked. "No." She leaned down into the open window. "But I know you." There was a ring shaped like a coffin on one of her fingers. Patrick wondered if the skeleton earrings fit inside it. She smelled sweet and slightly burned, like incense. To Patrick's dismay, her black tank top fell in such a way that he could see her lacy purple bra, whether he wanted to or not. Jesus. He looked back up at her face. Staring at him through thickly painted eyelashes, she said, "You're Patrick Cusimano. Your dad was the one who killed Ryan Zerpak."
We've just heard Save Yourself by Kelly Braffett. This
year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit IBRShop.com. That's IBRShop.com, where small is beautiful. Okay, readers, I can't resist. Next, we'll preview a debut novel by Owen King, Kelly Braffett's husband and the son of Stephen King. Yes, the Stephen King. In Double Feature, a young man must come to terms with his life and with the aftermath of making his first film. Filmmaker Sam Dolan has had a difficult relationship with his father, B-movie actor Booth Dolan, a boisterous, lying Lothario whose screen legacy falls somewhere between cult hero and pathetic. Allie, Sam's dearly departed mom, was a woman whose only fault, in Sam's eyes, was her eternal affection for his father. Unraveling the tumultuous, decade-spanning story of the Dolan family's friends, lovers, and adversaries, Double Feature is about letting go of everything, regret, resentment, ambition, dignity, the dead, and taking it again from the top. Holder Graham narrates.
The script was for a film called Who We Are, a drama set at Russell College, the small liberal arts school in northern New York where Sam had matriculated. The partly autobiographical story had been his senior thesis. Central to the design of the work was the way it compacted time by means of a trope that Sam privately considered so ingenious he sometimes broke into cackles just thinking about it. At the break of day, the narrative's half-dozen or so main figures are callow 18-year-old freshmen. But as the film advances, through parties and drugged-out drum circles, couplings and arguments and pranks, they age at a super-accelerated rate, encapsulating all 4 years of college in a single spring festival, the annual day-long bacchanalia that was the inebriated topper on every red-blooded Russell undergraduate's year. At sunup of the following morning, finally partied out, the characters are grown-up seniors on the verge of graduation, with different haircuts and thinner faces and better clothes, yet in every significant way no more prepared for the real world than when they started. While most readers of Who We Are found it funny in places, it was an essentially lyric piece that Sam felt spoke to the mad, arrested quality of those 4 years, and in general, of what a desperate thing it was to be young and free and American. One character, Rachel, is a button-down suburban honor student when we meet her in the morning. When we leave her 4 years later, she is a fully committed member of an eco-terrorist cell. Through the first quarter of the movie, Hugh drinks beer after beer, backslaps everyone in sight, climbs on every available chair and tabletop to make ribald acclamations to his friends. By the last 15 minutes or so, Hugh has stopped going out altogether, developed a policy of conducting communication exclusively via the internet or speakerphone, become too indolent to bother dressing himself, and just lies on his couch, gloating aloud about the energy that his old companions are wasting while he is relaxing. Another, Florence, renames herself Diana, and then Aurora, and then Divinity, before finally going back to Florence. The bright, gifted arts major who woke up that morning gradually transforming into a grim scold, her final project an installation of a dumpster filled with words carved from piss-soaked foam blocks. Empathy, truth, integrity, and so on. A gold chain-wearing high school football star, when we meet him, Brunson discovers his homosexuality during the first 20 minutes of the film, begins to treat his shame and anxiety with crystal meth around the 40-minute mark, and shortly afterward disappears completely right in the middle of a scene, at which point everyone ceases to refer to him except in the past tense. Kira spends the entire movie holding hands, only the person with whom she's holding hands keeps changing, and they're always arguing about that other person's lack of faithfulness. She becomes angrier and angrier until she literally bites her last lover and rips a chunk of flesh from his cheek. In a typical scene about midway through, Roger, the ostensible leader of the group, abruptly breaks up with his girlfriend, initially a humorous skeptic, by the film's latter stages, Roger has become so chronically dubious that he refuses to believe his own mother when she calls, sobbing, to inform him that his father has suffered a fatal aneurysm. "Nice try," he says, and hangs up on her. Several of the screenplay's characters were modeled on real people. Roger, for instance, was Sam's stand-in, and most of the things that happened to Roger, like the phone call scene, were semi-fictionalized versions of events from Sam's own life. Another key player, Hugh, was plainly based on Sam's best friend, Wesley Latch, who had in reality over time winnowed his direct human contact to the bare minimum and become so resolute in his fecklessness that there was a kind of integrity to it. Claire, Roger's girlfriend, was a dead ringer for Sam's actual college girlfriend, an indefatigably good-natured young woman named Polly Dressler. Exterior Northfield parking lot, mid-afternoon. The group comes to Roger's sob. Behind them, in the meadow and on the hillside, the festival continues. People jumping up and down in the bouncy castle, a juggler with devil sticks, the rotating Ferris wheel, etc. Claire. Slurpee time! Hugh. T-minus Slurpee.
Double feature by Owen King. On a fateful summer morning in 1986, two 11-year-old girls meet for the first time. By the end of the day, they will both be charged with murder. 25 years later, journalist Kirsty Lindsay is reporting on a series of attacks on young female tourists in a seaside vacation town when her investigation leads her to interview carnival cleaner Amber Gordon. For Kirsty and Amber, it's the first time they've seen each other since that dark day so many years ago. Now, with new, vastly different lives, will they really be able to keep their wicked secret hidden? Anna Batinick performs this gripping, fast-paced tale.
Martin checks his watch. It's nearly 10 o'clock. She'll be going to work soon. The neon lights on the roller coaster at Funland have been switched off. The halogen arc lights they flood the park with after hours, as much to drive stragglers away as to help the cleaners see the gobs of gum and the sticky soft drink splashes, the careless smears of ketchup, have come blazing on. She'll be in the changing rooms. Like a lot of punch card people, she is punctilious about arriving, more leisurely about actually starting work. She'll be shucking her civilian garb and replacing it with trackies and overalls. He feels a swell of familiar rage at the way she has just cut him off. No response, no contact, just empty silence day after day. Is she even thinking about him? He's left it 3 hours, but he can't stand the waiting any longer. He picks up the silent, baleful telephone and pulls up her number. Types in a text. Please answer me. Do not ignore me. Watches the screen as it thinks and sends. A hen party pauses in the street below. He knows it's a group of hens because they're bellowing, "Going to the chapel," at the tops of their voices. It's always that, or "Nice day for a white wedding." Just the chorus, over and over. Or "Here comes the bride, short, fat and wide." There are millions of songs, but hen parties never stray beyond this narrow selection. A shriek in the street, then a chorus of cackling. Someone's fallen over. Martin pushes himself off the bed and goes to the window, cracks open the curtain and looks out. 8 young women, in various stages of inebriation. The bride, shorty veil and L-plates, is on the ground, felled by 6-inch heels and a portly backside. She flumps about on the pavement in her tubular miniskirt, stomach flopping over the waistband and tits overspilling her décolletage, while 2 of her friends haul at a pale and dimpled arm. The other friends are scattered across the pavement, pointing and staggering as they howl with laughter. One of them, hot pants, giant hoop earrings, and a horizontal striped boob tube, is pestering men for a light as they weave their way past the flailing bride. Boob Tube strikes gold. A stag group. The town is overrun with them every weekend. The sort of stags who can't afford or who lack the passports or the probationary permission to spread sangria vomit over warm Spanish concrete, pause, light her up, fall into conversation. Well, mutual shouting. No one communicates under Martin's window at anything less than a roar. Ears destroyed by thumping bass lines. Sense of other people destroyed by the alcohol and ecstasy and cocaine that seem to cost less than a packet of smokes these days. And you don't have to go outside to take them. The bride finally regains her feet. She's limping, or pretending to, and uses the shoulder of a stag for support. Martin watches as the man's hand creeps down over the tube skirt, inches its way in from behind. The bride cackles, slaps him off half-heartedly, and bats her lashes encouragingly. The hand goes back. They set off up the street, heading towards the nightclub quarter. Boob Tube lags back, leaning against a shop window, talking to the man with a lighter. She sways from side to side, doesn't seem to notice as her friends disappear around the corner. She tugs at her top, pulling the droop from squashed bosoms, and flicks lacquered hair out of her eyes. Smiles at the man, coquettishly, pushes lightly at his upper arm. So goes the business of modern mating. You don't even need to buy a girl a drink anymore. Just lend her your lighter, and she's yours for the taking.
That was The Wicked Girls by Alex Marwood. National Book Award winner Sherman Alexie delivers a captivating semi-autobiographical account of one Spokane Indian's struggle against incredible obstacles in The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, which earned the number 2 spot in this year's banned book list. Born poor and hydrocephalic, Arnold's spirit survives brain surgery. But his enormous skull, lopsided eyes, profound stuttering, and frequent seizures target him for abuse on his Indian reservation. Protected by a formidable friend, the book-loving artist survives childhood. And then, convinced his future lies off the reservation, he enrolls in an all-white high school 22 miles away. The author narrates.
So obviously, I look goofy on the outside. But it was the inside stuff that was the worst. First of all, I had seizures, at least 2 a week, so I was damaging my brain on a regular basis. But the thing is, I was having those seizures because I already had brain damage, so I was reopening wounds each time I seized. Yep, whenever I had a seizure, I was damaging my damage. I haven't had a seizure in 7 years, but the doctors tell me that I am susceptible to seizure activity. Susceptible to seizure activity. Doesn't that just roll off the tongue like poetry? I also had a stutter and a lisp, or maybe I should say I had a stutter and a lisp. You wouldn't think there is anything life-threatening about speech impediments, but let me tell you, there is nothing more dangerous than being a kid with a stutter and a lisp. A 5-year-old is cute when he lisps and stutters. Heck, most of the big-time kid actors stuttered and lisped their way to stardom. And geez, you're still fairly cute when you're a stuttering and lisping 6-, 7-, and 8-year-old, but it's all over when you turn 9 and 10. After that, your stutter and lisp turn you into a retard. And if you're 14 years old like me and you're still stuttering and lisping, then you become the biggest retard in the world. Everybody on the res calls me a retard about 2 times a day. They call me retard when they are pantsing me or stuffing my head in the toilet or just smacking me upside the head. I'm not even writing down this story the way I actually talk, because I'd have to fill it with stutters and lisps, and then you'd be wondering why you're reading a story written by such a retard. Do you know what happens to retards on the res? We get beat up at least once a month. Yep, I belong to the Black Guy of the Month Club. Sure, I want to go outside. Every kid wants to go outside, but it's safer to stay at home. So I mostly hang out alone in my bedroom and read books and draw cartoons. I draw all the time. I draw cartoons of my mother and father, my sister and grandmother, my best friend Rowdy, and everybody else on the res. I draw because words are too unpredictable. I draw because words are too limited. If you speak and write in English or Spanish or Chinese or any other language, then only a certain percentage of human beings will get your meaning. But when you draw a picture, everybody can understand it. If I draw a cartoon of a flower, then every man, woman, and child in the world can look at it and say, "That's a flower." So I draw because I want to talk to the world, and I want the world to pay attention to me. I feel important with a pen in my hand. I feel like I might grow up to be somebody important, an artist, maybe a famous artist, maybe a rich artist. That's the only way I can become rich and famous. Just take a look at the world. Almost all of the rich and famous brown people are artists. They're singers and actors and writers and dancers and directors and poets. So I draw because I feel like it might be my only real chance to escape the reservation. I think the world is a series of broken dams and floods, and my cartoons are tiny little lifeboats. Why chicken means so much to me. Okay, so now you know that I'm a cartoonist. And I think I'm pretty good at it, too. But no matter how good I am, my cartoons will never take the place of food or money. I wish I could draw a peanut butter and jelly sandwich or a fistful of $20 bills and perform some magic trick and make it real. But I can't do that. Nobody can do that, not even the hungriest magician in the world.
That was The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian by Sherman Alexie. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Lainey Taylor's Days of Blood and Starlight is the stunning sequel to her highly acclaimed Daughter of Smoke and Bone. Find the preview of that earlier runaway bestseller on bookreportradio.com, archived shows, week of December 31st, 2011. In this title, Karou must come to terms with who and what she is and how far she'll go to avenge her people. Filled with mystery and secrets, new characters and old favorites, Days of Blood and Starlight brings the richness, color, and intensity of the first book to a brand new canvas.
The sky above Uzbekistan that night. The portal was a gash in the air. The wind bled through it in both directions, hissing like breath through teeth. And where the edges shifted, one world's sky revealed another's. Akiva watched the interplay of stars along the cut, preparing himself to cross through. From beyond, the Eret stars glimmered visible, invisible, and he did the same. There would be guards on the other side, and he didn't know whether to reveal himself. What awaited him back in his own world? If his brother and sister had exposed him for a traitor, the guards would seize him on sight. Or try to. Akiva didn't want to believe that Hazael and Laraz could have given him up, but their last looks were sharp in his memory. Laraz's fury at his betrayal, Hazael's quiet revulsion. He couldn't risk being taken. He was haunted by another last look, sharper and more recent than theirs. Karou. 2 days ago, she had left him behind in Morocco, with one backward glance so terrible that he'd almost wished she'd killed him instead. Her grief hadn't even been the worst of it. It was her hope, her defiant, misplaced hope that what he'd told her could not be true, when he knew with an absolute purity of hopelessness that it was. The Chimera were destroyed. Her family was dead. Because of him. Akiva's wretchedness was a gnawing thing. It was taking him in bites, and he felt everyone, every moment, the tearing of teeth, the chewing gut misery, the impossible waking nightmare truth of what he had done. At this moment, Karu could be standing ankle deep in the ashes of her people, alone in the black ruin of Loramendi. Or worse, she could be with that thing, Razgut, who had led her back to Eretz. And what would happen to her? He should have followed them. Karu didn't understand. The world she was returning to was not the one from her memories. She would find no help or solace there. Only ash and angels. Seraph patrols were thick in the former freeholdings, and the only Chimera were in chains, driven north before the lashes of slavers. She would be seen. Who could miss her, with her lapis hair and gliding wingless flight? She would be killed. Or captured. Akiva had to find her before someone else did. Razgut had claimed he knew a portal, and given what he was, one of the fallen, he probably did. Akiva had tried tracking the pair, without success, and had had no option, ultimately, but to turn and wing his way toward the portal he himself had rediscovered. The one before him now. In the time he had wasted flying over oceans and mountains, anything might have happened. He settled on invisibility. The tithe was easy. Magic wasn't free. Its cost was pain, which Akiva's old injury supplied him in abundance. It was nothing to take it and trade it for the measure of magic he needed to erase himself from the air. Then he went home. The shift in the landscape was subtle. The mountains here looked much like the mountains there, though in the human world the lights of Samarkand had glimmered in the distance. Here there was no city, but only a watchtower on a peak, a pair of serif guards pacing back and forth behind the parapet, and in the sky the true telltale of Eretz. Two moons, one bright, and the other a phantom moon, barely there. Nidid, the Bright Sister, was the Chimera's goddess of nearly everything, except assassins and secret lovers, that is. Those fell to a lie. A lie. Akiva tensed at the sight of her. "I know you, Angel," she might have whispered, for hadn't he lived a month in her temple, drunk from her sacred spring, and even bled into it when the white wolf almost killed him? "The goddess of assassins has tasted my blood," he thought, and he wondered if she liked it and wanted more. "Help me to see Karu safe."
That was a sampling of Days of Blood and Starlight by Lainey Taylor. Wonderfully Entertaining, Dodger by Terry Pratchett, was one of this year's Audi Award nominees. A Storm, Rain-Lashed City Streets, A Flash of Lightning. A scruffy lad sees a girl leap desperately from a horse-drawn carriage in a vain attempt to escape her captors. Can the lad stand by and let her be caught again? Of course not, because he's Dodger. 17-year-old Dodger may be a street urchin, but he knows a jewel when he sees one. He's not about to let anything happen to the unknown girl, not even if her fate impacts some of the most powerful people in England. From Dodger's encounter with the mad barber Sweeney Todd, to his meetings with the great writer Charles Dickens and the calculating politician Benjamin Disraeli, history and fantasy intertwine in a breathtaking account of adventure and mystery. Stephen Briggs performs the story.
"Good heavens, Charlie, it's a girl, soaked to the skin and thrown into the gutter, I imagine," said one of them. "Come on."
"Hey, you, what are you a-doing, mister?"
By the light of a pub window that could barely show you the darkness, the aforesaid Charlie and his friend saw the face of a boy, who looked like a young lad no more than 17 years old, but who seemed to have the voice of a man. A man, moreover, who was prepared to take on both of them to the death. Anger steamed off him in the rain, and he wielded a long piece of metal. He carried on.
"I know your sort. Oh, yes, I do. Coming down here, chasing the skirt, making a mockery of decent girls. Blimey! Desperate, weren't you, to be out on a night such as this?"
The man, who wasn't called Charlie, straightened up.
"Now, see here, you. I object most strongly to your wretched allegation. We are respectable gentlemen, who, I might add, work quite hard to better the fortunes of such poor wretched girls, and, indeed, by the look of it, those such as yourself."
The scream of rage from the boy was sufficiently loud that the doors of the nearby pub swung open, causing smoky orange light to illuminate the ever-present rain.
"So that's what you call it, is it, you smarmy old gits?"
The boy swung his homemade weapon, but the man called Charlie caught it and dropped it behind him, then grabbed the boy and held him by the scruff of his neck. "Mr. Mayhew and myself are decent citizens, young man, and as such we surely feel it is our duty to take this young lady somewhere away from harm." Over his shoulder he said, "Your place is closest, Henry. Do you think your wife would object to receiving a needy soul for one night? I wouldn't like to see a dog out on a night such as this." Henry, now clutching the young woman, nodded.
"Do you mean two dogs, by any chance?"
The struggling boy took immediate offence at this, and with a snake-like movement was out of the grip of Charlie and once again spoiling for a fight.
"I ain't no dog, you knobby sticks, nor ain't she. We have our pride, you know. I make my own way, I does, all kosher, straight up."
The man called Charlie lifted the boy up by the scruff of his neck so that they were face to face. "My, I admire your attitude, young man, but not your common sense," he said quietly. "And mark you, this young lady is in a bad way. Surely you can see that. My friend's house is not too far away from here, and since you have set yourself up as her champion and protector, why then I invite you to follow us there and witness that she will have the very best of treatment that we can afford. Do you hear me? What is your name, mister? And before you tell it to me, I invite you to believe that you are not the only person who cares about a young lady in dire trouble on this dreadful night. So, my boy, what is your name?" The boy must have picked up a tone in Charlie's voice, because he said,
"I'm Dodger. That's what they call me, on account of I'm never there, if you see what I mean. Everybody in all the boroughs knows Dodger."
"Well then," said Charlie, "now we have met you and joined that august company, we must see if we can come to an understanding during this little odyssey, man to man." He straightened up and went on, "Let us move, Henry, to your house, and as soon as possible, because I fear this unfortunate girl needs all the help we can give her. And you, my lad, do you know this young lady?" He let go of the boy, who took a few steps backward.
"No, guv'nor, never seen her before in my life, God's truth, and I know everybody on the street. Just another runaway. Happens all the time, so it does. It don't bear thinking about."
"Am I to believe, Mr. Dodger, that you, not knowing this unfortunate woman, nevertheless sprang to her defence like a true Galahad?" Dodger suddenly looked very wary.
"I might be, I might not. What's it to you, anyway? And who the hell is this Galahad cove?"
Charlie and Henry made a cradle with their arms to carry the woman. As they set off, Charlie said over his shoulder, "You have no idea what I just said, do you, Mr. Dodger? But Galahad was a famous hero. Never mind. You just follow us, like the knight in soaking armour that you are, and you will see fair play for this damsel, get a good meal, and, let me see," coins jingled in the darkness, "yes, 2 shillings, and if you do come, you will perhaps improve your chances of heaven, which, if I am any judge, is not a place that often concerns you. Understand?"
We've just heard a sampling of Dodger by Terry Pratchett. Readers, the ability to choose what we want to read is a very precious freedom. Like you, I wholeheartedly support the American Library Association's efforts to end censorship. So keep turning those pages. If you need ideas on titles for your reading list, check my website, bookreportradio.com.
Thanks so much for joining me today, and see you back here in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.